This is KPDO 89.3 FM serving Pescadero and the South Coast. And my guest today is Catalina Gomes, I'm very privileged to meet. And Catalina is the founder of the Muchiate Indigenous Land Trust. So, Catalina, I can't just ask you how you got here because there's such a long story to that. So, why don't you just begin with your credentials, your background, your knowledge of your original, the people that you came from.
Hershey Tuhi. Greetings in the Ramaytush language. My name is Catalina Gomes. I have documented lineage to three different tribes here on the Central California area. Growing up, I knew I was documented 12th generation Californian.
Wow.
And through my great-grandmother's lineage, we knew that we had Sililian tribal connections. And their tribal area is just south of Monterey, the Santa Lucia Range, Big Sur, down almost to Santa Barbara. And then we would be bordering Chumash, would be to the south of our territory.
Wow, that's far south.
Yeah, it's a very large coastal area.
Mm-hmm.
Very rugged terrain.
Yeah, I've been through Chumash. It is very rugged.
Yeah. And so we knew that for quite a while. But then recently it came to light that our great-great-grandfather was adopted and we didn't know his lineage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about 5 years ago. And at around the same time, one of my cousins was retiring and had extra time and wanted to work on our family genealogy. And so he did look into that and found that it was true that our great-great-grandfather was adopted. And then he traced his genealogy to the Ramaytush tribe here on the San Francisco Peninsula and also to Babe Miwok a little further to the east.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the three documented lineages that I have. But I imagine there's probably quite a few more, because it was really very common for indigenous groups here to marry into neighboring groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of that would have been pre-recorded history.
Okay. Now, having found out about this, I know you've done a lot of things about it. And so why don't you talk a little bit about your land trust?
Okay. Well, in doing the research on our genealogy, we were lucky to find records in Mission Dolores in San Francisco. And not only were the record takers there very diligent in recording our ancestors' indigenous names, they also recorded the name and location of our village site as well.
Oh, wow.
So Muchiate is the matriarch of our family who's documented at Mission Dolores in 1783, and so she's the matriarch of our family who links us to the tribe here on the San Francisco Peninsula.
Okay.
So in her honor, I was asked to start a nonprofit Indigenous Land Trust because we're partnering with another nonprofit, Deep Medicine Circle and Post, and have conservatorship of a 38-acre farm in San Gregorio.
I've heard about this farm. I understand that you produce quite a bit of food on that farm, which you give away. Am I right about that?
Yes, this is our first season of harvest. We had a cover crop in the winter. The farm had previously not been farmed for over 8 years, which was fortunate for us because we wanted to go organic, and the land had been used in a commercial way before with a lot of chemicals that we weren't wanting to use. So it gave the earth a chance to rest and recover. And so this, we were just coming out of our first harvest season. We've been harvesting about 1,200 pounds weekly.
Mm-hmm.
Organic produce getting distributed to 5 different food hubs up in the San Francisco city area.
Okay.
And then also recently we added Coastside Hope to our weekly deliveries as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point is that we're trying to nurture the earth and take care of the earth in a good way and take care of the people who reside here, not just indigenous people, but the whole community.
Oh, great.
And so the goal is to get healthy organic food to communities who cannot afford to purchase organic.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been what we've been accomplishing this last several months.
That's fantastic. So you are working with these organizations that mm-hmm. serve homeless people.
Mm-hmm. Or low-income communities, senior mm-hmm. distribution food
okay.
sites, and
okay.
things like, of that nature.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, that is a beautiful way to honor the earth and its people.
Well, actually, I was asked to rename the farm. And I gave it the indigenous name of Tekwe Anyaweap, which translates to Honor Mother Earth.
Oh,
so we
beautiful.
Hope to live up to our name of our farm.
Uh-huh.
Food production is just one facet of what we have happening there at the farm.
Okay.
So besides harvesting organic produce, we're also working on creek restoration of the riparian corridor.
Okay.
Working with RCD and other agencies.
How many people do you have?
Well, we have a limited staff that are farming, but we're also dependent on volunteer help to pull out invasive Cape ivy and poison hemlock. And starting in January, we want to start a regular monthly volunteer day.
Oh, great.
But we're also on the calendar. It's such a huge overtaking that it's really beyond our capability of dealing with it with just volunteer help. And so we're on the calendar for California Conservation Corps.
Oh, great.
To come in next summer in 2023 and do a massive crew to come in.
That's
and
fantastic.
Help with that. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully after that, we'll be able to keep up on it with volunteer help, but it's going to be a several year project.
Yeah, I remember seeing the CCC come in to Año Nuevo, and oh my gosh, it was a huge crew, and they did a tremendous amount of work in just a few months. So
yeah.
That's a big boost.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful that you have that. So you're partnering mm-hmm. with Post. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
So is this property, you know, owned, at least legally, entitled by Post?
Yes, currently it is.
I see.
We are in the process of obtaining our nonprofit status.
Okay.
We hope to be complete with that in the beginning of 2023.
Mm-hmm.
And after that point, we were hoping to do land back,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and having it be under indigenous stewardship. Not only for harvesting food, organic food, restoration of the creek, the riparian corridors, but also we have a 100-foot hay barn
mm-hmm.
that we are converting to our indigenous cultural center as well.
Oh, fantastic. Now, how many people in your tribe come to the farm, or are you aware of or are connected to the farm in some way?
Well, I've reached out to several tribal members as this project started to come into fruition. And currently we have our board of directors is a majority Ramaytush women-led organization. And we also have a Ramaytush firekeeper and a Ramaytush songkeeper as well. And so we are trying to reach out to include as many Ramaytush descendants as are interested in being involved in this project.
How many do you think that is?
It's very limited. For 100 years, the academics, specifically Clover from UC Berkeley, in about 1915, and I think he published it in the 1920s, that the indigenous inhabitants of the San Francisco Peninsula were extinct. So for 100 years, the academics have been claiming that we don't exist.
Yeah.
And it's just, I would say, within the last decade that people are doing their genealogy and documentation and proving that for 100 years the academics have been wrong. Mm-hmm. There are not very many known living descendants. Muchiate, who I mentioned earlier, she and her husband Euctus, the only known living descendants of the tribe are all of their lineage. Mm-hmm. So it's very limited, mm-hmm. the amount of people are known to survive.
Right.
There could be other survivors, but they just haven't done their family genealogy to document it and mm-hmm. know.
Well, if they have good records at Mission Dolores, that's mm-hmm. a huge help, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So I hope that more people are found. I'm sure there's probably more than the limited number you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah.
Now, I understand, you know, we met at the Pescadero Arts and Fun Festival, and I understand that you had determined that there was a center or village or a spot where the Rametush met in what is now, say, Rockaway Beach or Valamar up in Pacifica. Is that right?
Well, we actually did an archaeological study on the farm before we tilled any soil. And so the archaeologist, Mark Hackelma, had come in, and we actually have a cultural site on the farm.
Oh, you do?
We do. It currently has an old barn on it, which we are trying to work with permits with the county to dismantle and reestablish that footprint of a barn in a different location. Mm-hmm. But also, I think what you're referencing to Pacifica is that our village site is originally in Pacifica.
Yeah, that's what I think you were talking to me about.
Yes, there were actually two village sites in Pacifica. The larger one is located where currently is the Sanchez Adobe.
Oh, yeah.
That's the village site of Peristac.
Okay.
And that was the larger of the two villages in Pacifica. And the reason why the adobe was built there is that during the mission era, the mission in San Francisco was using that valley where Peristac was located for growing the food to supply to the mission.
Oh.
And they chose that site because it's a beautiful little valley.
Yeah.
4 miles inland from the coast. And being the larger of the two village sites, they had free slave farm workers there.
So I know that site well. I grew up in Lindemar, which mm-hmm. we went to the Sanchez Adobe many mm-hmm. a time, and my elementary school that I mm-hmm. went to was Sanchez Elementary, which mm-hmm. is right next door practically. Mm-hmm. So we went there just to study how the early Mexican families lived mm-hmm. and their construction. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that that's also where there was a village.
A very large village site there as well.
Now, were the Rametush like Ohlone Indians? Were they hunter-gatherers? Were they farmers? What were they doing?
Well, to finish up on the village sites in Pacifica, Peristac is not my village site.
Okay.
Our village site is actually the smaller of the two and lies a little farther to the north along Calera Creek.
Okay.
And so that was the smaller of the two villages, much closer to the coast. And the name of that village is Temigtaq. So in my research at Berkeley with the Indigenous Language Program there, we, working with a linguist, translated the names of those two village sites. Temigtaq translates to the place of the whales.
Ah.
And that makes sense because we're so close to the coast.
Right.
The other Peristac translated to the place of the sandbill cranes.
Oh, wow.
So apparently there used to be a large flock of cranes that migrated through there.
Oh, wow.
And so those are the original names of those two village sites.
That just conjures up such interesting images of what mm-hmm. the wildlife must have been like then. How
yes,
rich.
Yes. I personally don't use the term Ohlone to describe myself. It was a term, it's a misnomer, thought to be started by the Portola expedition.
Okay.
So it was a term that was created by colonizers. When the Portola expedition came to this part of California, they set anchor near Año Nuevo, mm-hmm. and then came to shore and walked on foot up the coast. They stopped in San Gregorio, ironically, very much near where the farm is located, and camped there. There were two village sites there, and the Portola expedition camped between the two villages. Since they had been on board ship for such a long time, the people from the expedition were not in very good physical condition, mm-hmm. suffering from, you know, scurvy, right. and various other nutritional problems. And so the local people there in that valley tended to the people from the ship, the strangers who came. And I heard that they had actually fed them seed cakes, mm-hmm. that were very rich and high in vitamin C, and nourished them back to health. That local tribal area there where they had camped is called Ohon. Mm-hmm. It's currently spelled O-L-J-O-N, Ohon. Mm-hmm. But that would have been like a Spanish pronunciation of the indigenous people there. Mm. And so it's thought that out of gratitude to the people who nourished them back to health, that the Portola expedition then referred to all the people of the entire San Francisco and Monterey Bay areas as Ohones,
oh.
adding a Spanish plural. Okay. To that group who had helped them.
Huh.
And so it's a misnomer. It's a reconstruction of a triblet there. Mm-hmm. And it's also an umbrella over many, many tribes.
Yes.
And so as a term being used today to the general public, it works as an eraser of the tribes that are under that umbrella.
The individual,
yeah.
specific tribes.
So I don't use the term myself to describe myself. I get more specific, you know, as Sililian or Ramaytush or Bay Miwok.
Okay.
And so I don't use the term Ohlones.
Okay.
But my family survived the mission system. We also survived the Mexican era that followed, which much of our lands were dispersed. And then after statehood, things got really much worse. Over 80% of the people did not survive the mission system.
Wow.
But
I did not know that.
I mean, yes.
People actually were dying in those numbers?
Yes. That's why all the missions have cemeteries with them. Over 80% of the indigenous people did not survive the missions.
Was it like mumps and measles, or what was it?
It was a combination of malnutrition, being fed food that the people weren't used to eating, diseases that were brought by the soldiers and the missionaries, being worked to death. They've studied skeletal remains of young children that they could tell that their bodies were really stressed from carrying things that were way too heavy for young people to be carrying. And so it was a combination of disease, malnutrition, and literally being worked to get to death. And in fact, going on the mission records, it was kind of interesting. Muchiate herself was baptized in 1783, but her daughter had been brought into the mission and baptized 5 years prior. We really don't know the whole story, but from looking at the dates and going over her baptism certificate, Muchiate's death certificate was written 3 days later.
Oh.
It was common that they abducted the children and took them into the mission and used them as bait to lure other tribal members and family members in. It's my theory, since her daughter had been there for 5 years prior, and it said on her baptism certificate that she was on her deathbed, mm-hmm. and then died 3 days later. I kind of think that perhaps she was ill and knew she was dying and went to the mission to be able to see her daughter before she passed. Mm-hmm. It's total conjecture, but just from looking at the dates.
Right.
And so it was not a pleasant experience for people who had, they're considered complex hunter-gatherers.
Okay.
Because they did tend the wild. It wasn't a type of agriculture that we think of when we think of a European farm. But, you know, as it's coming to light, there was a lot of cultural burning that happened here.
Right.
And to get rid of the plants they didn't want and to stimulate the ones they did. Also, getting the plant material in the form that they wanted. The Californians here were very known for their expert basketry.
Right.
And so in making a basket, you want all the materials to be pretty long, straight lengths and of similar size. And so they did a lot of that by either cutting back or burning back, mm-hmm. and then stimulating the new growth that could be used.
Yeah, I read about something like that where they would take, say, 10,000 acres, if we want to use some round numbers, and mm-hmm. would divide it into, say, several sections where they'd burn a section every year, and then every year they'd harvest from that what they needed, a different thing. You know, like the first year they might get some sprouts or roots, mm-hmm. and the second year they might get some fibers that you're talking mm-hmm. about, and the third year they might get something that would make something else. You know, so they had something in mind. Every year of the recovery from a burn
mm-hmm. yeah.
would produce some material that they could use in their artwork, in
right.
their handicrafts, or whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, they had it all. You know, when you think about it, they were here for thousands of years, adapted
mm-hmm.
totally to managing this land
mm-hmm.
in a way that served them.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of were the land managers.
Yeah, they were the stewards of the land.
Right.
In fact, cultural burning is much different than a controlled burn.
Mm-hmm.
Controlled burn, it would be just going in and burning a whole large area, whereas a cultural burn has more of a system to it and is more selective on particular plants
mm-hmm.
and burning them for a specific reason. So it's much more honed in to the cycle of things.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the feeling you get when you read about, for example, managing the land in such a way that the elk and the deer mm-hmm. and the antelopes and all those different
mm-hmm.
Ungulates, those animals with the sharp hoofs that
mm-hmm.
Were in those families, how they cleared the land so that they could have those animals grazing.
Yeah, those grazing animals really were a great benefit to the land itself. I've been in touch with a gentleman named Rick Landman who has experience reintroducing elk herds.
Oh, fantastic.
Here in California, and does research on proving that the beavers were indigenous not only to the Sierra waterways, but the coastal waterways as well. And so,
that's really new. I did not know that.
Yeah, Rick Landman has been doing incredible research on these things and has reintroduced elk in the East Foothills of San Jose, near
wow.
populated areas.
We have so much grassland around
yeah.
here. I mean, there's so much in the way of state parks, county parks,
yeah.
all kinds of stuff.
Well, apparently, the good news is the elk are coming back to the peninsula, and it seems like the most likely way it's going to happen is through Stanford.
Oh.
Stanford has a project in the works, and they have an ecological study area called Jasper Ridge. To my knowledge, they haven't started soft penning yet. According to Rick, before the herd is released, they find a secluded area, build a corral. The herd is fed and watered for a year to acclimate them to mm-hmm. the area. So that's called referred to as soft penning.
Now, what happens with the mountain lions? I mean, the mountain lions are in a huge population here, mm-hmm. and I'm sure elk were one of their prey. How do they protect them from the mountain lions to start with?
Well, they're a pretty formidable creature themselves in stature. Mm. And of course, you know, the mom would be very protected. The young would be the most vulnerable.
Sure.
But, you know, as a herd animal, the parents would be very protected of them.
And they survived.
Lions,
yeah.
The mountain lions would pick off, like, the weakest, the most vulnerable.
Sure.
So they actually serve a purpose in calling the members of the herd that aren't as strong.
Right.
So the mountain lions do serve a beneficial purpose.
Oh, yes, I totally agree with that. I'm just saying in the beginning when you're doing this penning, the soft penning, how do you keep the...
There would be somebody to keep an eye on.
Okay.
So, you know, there's someone tending to their food and water
right.
on a regular basis.
I think to the extent we can recreate the ecosystem of the past, that would be so fantastic. I mean... This is one reason why we're trying to keep people in certain little villages instead of spread out all over the place.
Yeah.
We learned in our planning of, you know, how when we're putting in like affordable housing, you want everybody to live in like a little village, so that's a good place that they can then help each other out, and there can be buses or whatever, but you don't want people just scattered all over the place because they become vulnerable.
Right.
And then it's hard for the ecosystem to recover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, so we're excited that it seems like the Tule elk are coming back to the peninsula.
That's so fantastic.
We're hoping the same will be true of the beavers. The beavers are great stewards of the waterways, and the ecosystems that they create are really beneficial to many other species.
Right.
And they've even found that it was helpful in areas where there's a beaver community as far as fire reduction as well.
Really?
Because the soil is so well irrigated by the activities of the beavers that the fire actually goes around the areas where the beavers are.
That's interesting.
So they're very beneficial in many ways.
Huh.
So hopefully the beaver will be making a comeback soon.
I just want to remind people, I'm talking to Catalina Gomes, who goes by the name Cata, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about helping to restore the land in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like you guys have a vision of where you want this to go.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like total restoration? What are you thinking about?
I don't think total restoration is possible because there is so much development that has taken place. But we want to do our part in creating a future that we would like to see.
Mm-hmm.
A community of caring and nurturing in all forms, the land, the air, the water, the people, the creatures. We're really lucky. We're bordered on three sides at the farm by creeks.
Wow.
Yes, and we've been keeping a close eye. We've been seeing some red-legged frogs have been identified.
Mm-hmm.
We currently have about...
That could be San Francisco garter snake territory.
There could be. We just haven't seen them yet.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And also, we have about 30 baby steelhead in the creek right now. And we've videotaped last spring a salmon, and we've seen a baby coho salmon
in
the creek as well.
Oh, great.
And so...
Recovery.
Yeah, right there in our own little microclimate, since it hadn't been farmed in almost a decade, mm-hmm. it's really created an oasis for the wildlife there.
That's fantastic.
Because there hasn't been very much human activity on site. Mm-hmm. And so we're really blessed to have an abundance of wildlife. We have a motion camera photos of a mountain lion, bobcats. We also have a pair of great blue herons that walk through the fields at dawn, hunting gophers.
I love that.
We have a nesting pair of red-tailed hawks that the last two springs we've been able to watch the babies fledge.
Oh, that's so great.
And we have barn owls. We have great horned owls. You know,
It sounds heavenly. I'd love to go. Now, you're asking or wanting volunteers, do people have to be given orientation or training, or how can they help?
Yes, we are planning on, hopefully in January, to start a monthly, one day a month volunteer work day. We're looking at the second Sunday of each month. Mm-hmm. We are going to have someone oversee that and coordinate it. When I was at Pescadero Art and Fun Festival for those 2 days, each day we got so much positive response from the community that each day I just about filled up an entire sheet of email addresses.
Oh, fun.
So
lots of people to contact.
Lots of people interested in what we're doing and very supportive. So much so that we're going to be limiting how many people show up.
Sure, you have to. Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a small team working together. And
are you familiar with Pie Ranch?
Yes.
Yeah, and they have a volunteer program, and they have to kind of limit it as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. They're trying to make sure that everything in certain areas is native, mm-hmm. native plants, and they're trying to, you know, keep everything in mm-hmm. in such a way that it fosters the environment, of course.
Yeah.
Yours are way more intentional about the environment, I think, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, and there's a difference there also. The tribe that they've been working with is the Amamutsen tribe. Mm-hmm. This is not their ancestral homelands. And I would like to commend them and Val Lopez and all his tribal members for the work that they have done. It's been excellent, the quality of care that they have given to the land. But there is an issue with them operating outside of their ancestral homelands without receiving permission to do so.
Hmm.
And so
this is where we should talk about the statement that this is Ramatush lands. I mean, we had talked in the very beginning before we began this recording about the fact that many organizations in our area will begin on their website by saying that this their property is on unceded lands of the Ramatush
yes.
tribe. And maybe you can expand on that just a bit. What does that really mean?
Okay, the term unceded has become a very popular term, but not many understand the true meaning. And what it means is unceded means that, and this holds true to 99.9% of the state of California, that the land was never occupied, it was never obtained by means of a treaty. Hmm. So the entire state of California, with very few exceptions, which are run by indigenous people, are on stolen land. Hmm. There was never any compensation to anyone for the land. And that's why things were so detrimental at the beginning of statehood hmm. for the indigenous people. Because they just wanted to remove the people from the land to access the gold that was happening at that time.
Right.
And so one of the first laws passed by the state of California was to put a bounty on Native people, pay for their scalps and per ear. And it also, another aspect of that in the law was if you could prove that both the mother and father were dead, because you had murdered them, It was legal for you to take their children and work them as indentured servants, as farm ranch laborers on your ranches. And so...
Wow, the inhumanity of that. It's hard for us to understand that things were that bad. I mean, I don't think most people know the real history.
Yeah, it's not what's being taught in the school. And it was so blatant that even the government, the state of California itself, referred to it as the era of extermination.
Mm.
And in fact, there was just a controversy about the Hastings Law School in San Francisco, because it came to light that Hastings, that the school was named after, was actually personally involved in the massacre of a Yaqui village.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Yaqui tribe were asking for a renaming,
mm-hmm.
which recently happened, mm-hmm. not to their satisfaction, because it was given a Spanish name and not a Yaqui name to honor the dead.
Mm-hmm.
But it's now renamed the San Francisco Law School.
Well, my feeling is that many people will be hearing this for the first time. Mm-hmm. We have a small community, but we share these interviews with the Coast Side, with various other media outlets, and I have a feeling a lot of people are unaware of this. And I'm just wondering, what do you hope changes over time? What is your ultimate strategy or plan in terms of getting recognition for your tribe?
Well, my goals are not to get federally recognized. We are so small that we don't meet the bureaucratic criteria that is required by both the state and the federal government for recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And it, to me, the purpose of getting that recognition is monetary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not of interest to me. What is more of interest is educating the public at large, and the curriculum in the schools is inaccurate. You know, just the fact that the Amamutsin have been active here in San Mateo County, it's giving the wrong impression to the general public that they think this is Amamutsin territory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's far from Amamutsin territory. Their ancestral homeland is basically mostly in San Benito County, a small part of Santa Clara County, and a very small part of northern Monterey County. Their ancestral homelands is not Santa Cruz County, and definitely not San Mateo County. So there's a lot of misunderstandings and misinformation that is being put out there into the public. And so I really feel like educating and truth-telling is a major goal, as well as learning our language. We haven't had any native speakers in over 100 years.
Mm.
So our vocabulary list is very limited, but in the few months that I've been working with the linguists at UC Berkeley, we've been able to add to that vocabulary list. And
that's great. So you're trying to recover your language.
Yes, we're going to start a language program. We're hoping soon. And we're hoping again in January, in that hay barn that I mentioned that we're converting to our cultural center.
Mm-hmm.
We plan on having an herbal apothecary, a library, a classroom for teaching indigenous arts and languages, and also having the whole center of the barn open for large gatherings. I have a cousin who is very musically talented, so I'm really excited to include him in the upcoming language classes that we're going to be having.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we want to learn is how to introduce ourselves in public, because that's culturally how you would present yourself in a public situation,
mm-hmm.
would be introducing yourself in your own language.
Mm-hmm. And you did that when you first came on the air. So tell me, tell me again, how do you greet? What is the greeting?
Well, the initial greeting is Hershey Tuhi, which is like a good greeting, Hershey being good. And so it's an expression of goodwill that you are greeting people with. But one of the things we want to do is also try to bring back our songs, because we've been so cut off from our culture for many hundreds of years.
I would love to hear recordings of that, those songs. That would be so so great. We would be happy to play them on the radio.
Oh, I should have brought my clapper stick. Maybe another time I'll come sing you the Honoring Mother Earth song, which is where I got the name for the farm.
We're very eclectic here. We have music of all sorts, and one of our favorite programs is called Music of the San Mateo Coast. And hey, we've got to include your music in that. That would be so fun. That I love. You know, I would love to talk to you much more. I mean, we have got to have a steady conversation. I'd like to know how your farm progresses and you know, how we can help you, how the community can take part. So I hope we continue to have some conversations and you can update us as things progress.
You know, the community has been so supportive of us, and we're just getting so much love and support. And some people are already starting to return artifacts that, you know, have turned up in the fields or washed up on the beach.
Like what?
Mostly stones. A woman that I know here in Pescadero, her son, they were at the beach, and they were leaving the beach one day, and they were already, like, packing up and going home and taking off. And she's going, "What is that you have in your hood?" He had a hoodie on, his sweatshirt, but something was very heavy in his hood. He goes, "Oh, it's just a rock that I found. It's actually a stone that sort of... it's a very unique stone, probably about 10 inches long, but more of an hourglass shape to it. Like it has an indentation along the middle of it where you could tell that it had been bound."
Oh. And so maybe used as an axe or something?
No, this was found at the beach, and so we thought it might have been like an anchor. But I recently attended a lecture at the Half Moon Bay History Society, where Mark Hackelma had done a slideshow, and he showed some of these stones that were bound with a fiber made out of dog bane and then had attached to it an abalone shell fish hook. So it was actually used for fishing.
Oh, interesting.
It was like a weight with a length tied to it. So we have that and the pestle. You know, mortar and pestles, those type of things. You know, people are tilling their fields and they'll...
Now, did the Ramage fish also harvest the acorns from the oak trees?
Yes, yes.
I think all of the tribes did that.
All of Central California, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, down in the desert areas, probably not as much.
Right.
But, yeah, all the places where oak trees grew in California, they were used as a food source.
A primary starch kind of food source,
Very high in nutrients.
So, and very difficult to process. It was like daily.
It's a huge process.
Very time-consuming. Do you know that process?
I know the process, but I don't practice it regularly.
Yeah, because that would be so hard.
And especially if you're, you know, preparing for a large community, if you're feeding the whole village.
Yeah, imagine
the
work.
A lot of work.
Yeah. Well, that would be an interesting story. I can just kind of see it. So basically, you're at a beginning point. I mean, you're just getting your nonprofit status. You've just found some of this information about your genealogy. You've just gotten your farm working over the last year. You've just, you know, kind of identified the places that you've been. So it's a beginning. It's definitely a beginning, but it sounds like you're making some tremendous progress.
Yes, in just a year's time, I have learned so much, and it seems like every week I'm learning something new. It's really exciting at this stage of my life. A year and a half ago, I never would have imagined that I would be doing this work of rematriation of land. But in hindsight, my entire life has been preparing me.
Oh, perfect. That's so great.
Yeah, I was actually born in San Jose in the 1950s. And so I witnessed the transition of the Santa Clara Valley going from mostly agricultural. Mm-hmm. We were called the Valley of the Heart's Delight.
That's right.
It's the richest topsoil on the planet in the Santa Clara Valley, 18 to 20 feet deep.
Oh my goodness.
It is the prime agricultural land.
Wow.
On the planet.
And then it got completely occupied
and
with
tractors. I witnessed the transition from the Valley of the Heart's Delight to the Silicon Valley.
Right.
And it was heart-wrenching for me as a child. So as a young adult, I moved up to the Santa Cruz Mountains, up into the Redwood Forest, and just surrounded myself with nature. And so I have lived there ever since. And so I have lived out in the Redwood Forest for over 40 years, off the grid,
wow,
with no electricity.
Wow.
I was an educator, and I taught a program called Life Lab. It is a organic gardening and natural science program that the curriculum was developed in the 1970s at UC Santa Cruz.
Hmm.
And so I taught that for 20 years. I was trained in the salmon and trout education program. So I had I had permits from Fish and Game at that point. Now it's called Fish and Wildlife. To have endangered species in my possession, because every year I would create a tank with a chiller and just all the right conditions for baby steelhead. The hatchery would deliver eggs to me annually, and we would incubate them in the classroom and teach the children about watersheds and life cycles and habitats. And then after the eggs would hatch, we would take the children on a field trip to the river, and they would get to release a baby steelhead into the river.
Wow.
And then...
So you know a lot about restoration.
Yes.
Not just...
Firsthand.
Whole life.
That's what I'm saying.
Totally.
My whole life
practical. Wow.
Preparing me. My mother's lineage is Californian, but my father is of Spanish descent. And he was born and raised in Hawaii. So I actually grew up with a lot more of the Hawaiian culture than my own native Californian culture.
Mm.
Although there are a lot of similarities. But in that, I also paddled outrigger canoes for 20 years with a club in the Santa Cruz Yacht Harbor.
You're kidding.
So I've spent a lot of time out on the ocean and... teaching people how to steer a canoe in the ocean with a paddle, no motors.
Sounds like you were sort of born to this.
So that's what I'm saying. In hindsight, my entire life has been preparing me. My indigenous great-grandmother, when I was very young, I never understood why she had so much say over what happened to me as a child. But she saw something in me that I think some of my other cousins were jealous of.
Mm-hmm.
I never understood. She never let my mother cut my hair. And I only later as an adult learned that that was a very indigenous thing. I didn't have my hair cut until I went into junior high school.
Wow.
So I had hair down to my knees a child. And so unknowingly being raised with some indigenous culture, but not aware of it, because the family didn't speak of our indigenous tribal connections. One of my younger cousins asked me if I ever overheard my mother and our grandmother speaking of our tribal connections. And I said, no, never. The only thing my mom would say is that we come from hardy stock. I think it was a form of protection not to acknowledge our tribal lineage because of the genocide that had happened and it still continues in California and all over the continent. There's a huge issue of missing and murdered indigenous women
You know, my granddaughter is a Sioux Indian, and she is MWIW everywhere. Missing.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Missing and murdered.
Missing and murdered indigenous women. It's a huge thing.
And children,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. I have an adopted granddaughter who is Sioux Indian. So it's, it's true everywhere.
Statistics are indigenous women are 5 times greater chance of being murdered.
Yeah.
Than white women.
It's unreal.
Yeah, it's a huge issue and it's not being covered by the media or the police departments, you know.
Especially...
I know people whose daughters have been murdered.
Really?
And when the family goes to the police department asking about information, they were told, "We don't know anything and don't call us."
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so that's with the response of the police to this situation.
And right. I wish you the best. I want to say we're coming to the end of this fast-moving hour. It's like the clock was sped up. But I've learned so much and enjoyed so much talking to you, and we have to do this again soon.
Okay, and next time I'll bring my clapper stick and sing a song for you. And hopefully I'll have more songs to sing.
Okay, so again, I want to say, Catalina Gomes, and you are the founder of the Muchiate
Indigenous instead of Ohlone. Figure out a way to avoid the term.
And it sounds like there's so much you can teach us, and I've learned so much already from you. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
And I hope we can, really literally, I hope we can do this often.
Oh, good.
You know, and I'd love to hear updates on what's going on, and if you need any kind of word out about needing volunteers, or if you want anything from us as a radio station, I would just really be happy to help out.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So I just want to say in closing, this has been a wonderful conversation. This is Coastside Conversations. I'm Catherine Peary. My guest has been Catalina Gomes. And I hope we do this again soon.
Thank you. I do too.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much.